Amos Fortune, Chapter 5, Journey to Keene, 1779. On a mild June day in 1779, Amos Fortune rode the remaining miles between Woburn and Keene, New Hampshire. Two days he had been on his way, but on this third day he knew that he would reach his destination by nightfall. He had a good horse under him and strapped to his saddle a bundle of his finest leather, and he was a free man. No matter where his thoughts ranged as he jogged over the road, he kept coming back to that. Even though he had had his freedom now for just a month over 10 years, it was still a treasure to be brought forward in his mind and meditated on with delight. A strange thing freedom was, he thought, with its side of shadow as well as of light, for he was free, too, of household cares and domestic ties, and that saddened him. But only as a passing cloud dims the sun for a moment. All during the years of his servitude, he had longed for the sweetness of a home with a woman in it. But though he had been twice married, he had known that with both Lily and Lydia, the sweetness could not last for long. With Violet, he thought that it would be different, for she was younger than he and stronger. But she was a slave, and he could have her only at the purchase price. James Baldwin had put the price at £50, and Amos Fortune had to glance down the years to see the work he must do to amass that much money. The purchase price for Violet included Violet's little daughter, Celindia, and Amos was pleased to think that one deed would give freedom of two people. Celindia was 4 years old, dusky, sweet voice, and in her young eyes, Amos saw back into another lifetime. For Celindia, too, grown now in freedom would mean so much. To live on in bondage might mean the acceptance of barriers, perhaps for all her days. Amos had 10 pounds worth of leather with him. There was more work in his shop in Woburn that had been done and could be delivered. It might not be far away, that purchase price of £50. Easy now, Cyclops, he murmured, stroking his horse, and we'll both have a rest at the top. Cyclops slowed to a walk, and Amos thought of Joshua and the Promised Land, and of how the Lord told him to be strong and of good courage. He was like Joshua, he thought, for he too was seeking a new place to live and work, a place where he might build a home for Violet and Celindia, and they three might have such peace as was their portion. When he came to the top of a hill, he thought of Joshua no longer, but of Amos and his promised land, for spread before him was an area that represented all he could hope for happiness. There was a clearing and a collection of houses, with a sturdily built meeting house which faced a mountain rising up a rocky, lonely, splendor in the west. Face to face they were, the mountain and the house of God, two strong things, both pointing up. He loosed the reins so Cyclops could feed on the grass along the roadside, and he slid off the saddle to stand on his own 2 feet. His eyes swept the green fields flowing down from the hillside and up the mountain slope dotted with sheep and cattle. A sudden impulse that went far back into his past came over him, and he knelt down to press his lips to the earth. When he stood up again, he held his hat in his hand and looked at the mountain. I've asked you for a sign, Lord, many the time, and you've always given me one. I'm asking you now. It doesn't need to be anything big. Lord, I'll understand. If this is the place for me to start my life again, I'll thank you kindly for telling me so. Not right away, Lord, but when it conveniences you. Just sometime before I start the journey back to Woburn. He waited respectfully for a moment in case a sign should come soon. Then he picked up Cyclops' reins and mounted into the saddle. Amos Fortune went on his way singing. The cleared land gave again to forest, and his voice echoed through the woodland, merging with the singing of birds and running of a brook, the clopping of a horse's hoofs. His voice rolled out full and strong. He passed a signpost at a crossroad, and the hand that pointed over the road he had come said, Jeffrey, 6 miles, while the hand pointing ahead said Keene, 10 miles. He said the name Jeffrey over and over to himself, whispering it, singing it, speaking it, and every time it was as if he had entered his promised land. Cyclops was old, though he was a robust horse, and the fact that he had only one eye made Amos easy on him. He had been a poor piece of horse flesh when his owner had brought him to the tannery and asked Amos how much he would give for his hide. Amos had replied he would give him 10 pounds for the horse alive, and the deal had been closed with the exchange. A summer in pasture, good care, and something more than care, and the old horse took a new hold on life and was ready to give Amos service. When Amos' fortune reached Keene, he found stabling for Cyclops at the inn, but no lodging for himself. He shared the stall with his horse, pleased that the straw was clean and there was fresh water at hand to wash down the bread he had brought in his pack. Early in the morning, he paid the shilling asked for the horse's accommodation. It was expensive, but Amos knew that he could not question the white man's price. Too often, ill feelings were vented on a black man for no reason other than the color of his, other than his color and his inoffensiveness. Angry words could ensure that, and then the suspicion would be cast that the man might be a runaway slave. But against such occurrences, Amos carried on his person the certificate of his own manumission. He went on his way to seek Mr. Samuel George, to whom the leather was consigned. Finding him in his cobbler's shop on the south side of the town, Amos opened his packet and enrolled the leather before him. The cobbler had always prided himself in having a sharp eye for a flaw, but no matter how closely he examined Amos Fortune's work, he could find nothing wrong with it. He shook his head slowly, but the gesture gave Amos no concern. It was a gesture of approval, and the tanner recognized it as such. "I'm wishing we had a tanner such as you somewhere near," Mr. George said. "You've got a tanner down by the river," Amos commented. "I said such as you," George reminded him. He stroked the leather with his hands. It was smooth and supple. The best that was in the hide had been coaxed from it by knowing hands. Samuel George looked closely at the freed Negro facing him, and he thought that though the man had the look of being familiar with time, he bore none of the marks that time could leave. He was well-built and well-muscled, carrying his head high. There was gray in his hair, but his face was furrowed more by laughter than by years. There was a twinkle in Amos' eye when he asked, "How far would a man travel to get his hides tanned? 10 miles? Samuel laughed. "That's not half a day's journey. Why, man, if you were to settle anywhere in this countryside, you'd have people bringing their hides to you from miles around." When it came to paying out the money for the leather, Samuel George was slow in making the transaction. As he placed the last note in Amos's hand, he said, "It's good your leather costs no more, for I've come to the end of my money until my customers pay me." Amos folded 4 of the notes carefully away, but he held out 6 and said thoughtfully, "Would you like to have some of it on credit?" The cobbler looked like a hungry man being offered food. "I'd like to borrow some of those notes back again, if you're willing. I'll offer any security you like." Amos' eyes roved the small shop with his tools, trade, and bones and shoes. Then he looked at Samuel George, ample in girth in middle years. "There might be some clothes you could no longer wear, which would hang nicely on Amos' leaner build." "How about your go-to-meeting hat?" Amos began tentatively. "Would you want to part with it now?" The cobbler laughed. "You've chosen the one thing I've no more use for." He crossed the room to a press and took from it a fur hat, which looked as if it had not seen the light of a Sunday morning for a long time. He drew out a broadcloth coat and a patterned jacket with a stripe that was the same blue as the coat. "Here," he said, "you might as well take the lot. I've grown too big for them. Take them as security." "Or in sale?" Amos asked. "Either will suit me." Samuel George concluded, relieved to have six pound notes when he thought he was down to a few pence, and glad to have his press cleared of useless clutter. A half hour later, when Amos went down the road on Cyclops with his newly acquired garments in a neat bundle on the saddle, his fur hat on his head, Samuel George smiled to himself as he watched him go. "What he wants with all those fine clothes is hard to see," he said aloud to himself. They caught his fancy like a child's, but that's what they are, those black people, nothing but children. It's a good thing for them the whites took them over. In retracing his way, Amos stopped again on the hill that was Jeffrey. He faced the mountain the mountain he was leaving behind and talked to it as a man might to a friend. "I'll be back," he said. "Just you wait there, you old mountain, and we'll be soon talking together every day." Then he lifted his gaze a little higher and looked skyward. "Thank you kindly, Lord, for the sign you gave me back there in Keene, and thank you for all my fine clothes. Violet's going to be mighty proud when she sees me in them, but I'll keep them for our wedding day, her freedom day. So help me, Lord." It was November before Amos had the money ready for his purchase, and on the ninth day, he went to the house of James Baldwin, where Violet was a domestic, and Sandalia, for all her few years, was made to do more than a child's duties. An hour later, they walked out of the house together, the little girl following them. And the next day, they went to the church to be married. Violet wore the simple homespun dress she had made herself, and Amos wore the broadcloth coat, the gay jacket, and he had secured in Keene. The church register was signed. Amos Fortune and Violet Baldwin, blacks, both of Woburn, November 10th, 1779. The vows were made, the ring slipped on, and they left the church to begin their united life. Violet took a deep breath of freedom, and Sandalia ran ahead, chasing a small bird. The world belonged to them. Violet was no longer at the beck and call of a white man who would have her do his bidding. She was her own master now. She smiled at Amos. He had given her his love and her freedom. She had no words with which to thank him, but deep in her heart, she prayed that she might be his true helpmeet during the years remaining to them both. Celindia came running back to them as the bird flew off across a meadow, dipping to the grass, then soaring to a bush's height, balancing itself against the wind as it pursued some pattern of its own. "Why do you go on fluttering after the fluttering child?" Violet asked. "'Cause he flew over that field and we can't go there." "The world is yours, Celindia," Amos said quietly. "Don't you remember what I told you last night? You're as free as the birds in the air." A smile started to part Celindia's full lips, but before it had its way, the lips began to quiver and large dark eyes filled with tears. Amos stooped down to be on her level, and she threw her arms around his neck. "That's a strange thing for a child to do," Violet said apologetically. "She's getting your fine jacket all spotted." "Let her alone, Violet," Amos said as he patted Celindia's heaving shoulders. "Some things are too wonderful even for a child, and freedom's one of them."